depending on how I edit the last next couple and how much I use, this will probably be like something like 10 or 11 of our feudal podcast. Just to reassert or to assert for the first time, if you want to get a hold of us here at the Feudal Podcast, you can send an email to me, Ian, that's I-A-N, .strope@gmail.com. And that email will be something we'll reiterate later on when we move on to one of our newer segments, because we're going to try to have a little structure here and do a few segments where we pitch ideas to you, our listeners, the vast number of people that we have listening, no doubt, at this point. Okay, so about 2 or 3 days ago, you sat down and put yourself through the paces and watched the newest David Fincher film, Zodiac, correct?
Yes, I did.
Do you got any impressions you want to give, or just sort of you're a big Fincher fan, right?
I remember watching
the game with you years
ago.
Yeah,
and I'm mostly I've been a big fan of his style mostly growing up. When I was a teenager, I was more concerned with how something looked.
Absolutely, I get that.
And I could forgive a multitude of structural and character flaws because something looked incredible. And even though Michael Bay and Simon West and all those guys, the Jerry Bruckheimer guys, Tony Scott, all those guys have used the filter where it's like, you know, darker up at the top, gets lighter at the bottom, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That like the skies are always a certain color.
Yeah.
You know, the Tony Scott stuff, it's like a yellowish color, and the Michael Bay stuff's like a greenish color. Like sometimes, you know, in mm-hmm. Armageddon, I think he had a yellowish thing too. But Fincher's always done that better than them. And I think to a less, like...
I think Fincher's maybe a little less blatant about the style.
Oh, totally. But you can tell it's there. I actually enjoyed the movie Panic Room just because it's very... You know, it's during the background of the film, it's raining. You're inside this place. Every once in a while it goes outside. But you really get the sense that you're in this empty, cold place, that it's raining outside. It, like, you know, he's perfect at giving you the impression that you actually are where he sets it.
Gives you a sense of the environment.
And the entire time you're watching Seven, you never once doubt that you're in this terrible, depressing squalor, this city that everyone hates and no one can stand living in.
That I think is never mentioned specifically. I even read through the screenplay once for a screenwriting class and did a breakdown on it. I don't think that the city is ever specifically
mentioned. No, I don't believe so, not at all. No.
I mean, you could maybe infer that it's something like an L.A. because of the fact
could
at
be
the
a
end.
It seems to rain more than L.A. I couldn't tell you for sure. It could be
a
Bay Area. It could be Seattle. Could
dystopian Seattle, yeah.
I remember that Gwyneth Paltrow in one line says, I hate this city. And she's talking to Morgan Freeman in the cafe. And they use that... this hardcore band called Every Time I Die uses that as the beginning into one of their songs, right? She says that, and then it goes into the, you know.
Yeah.
It's just that has a very specific feel to it. Fight Club, you know, he's really good at matching or having the style. You know, Fight Club, if it was just done in a very straightforward manner, would probably just be kind of considered not that great a movie with a twist in it, you know?
Okay, yeah.
And the style really kind of becomes the substance when it's him.
And the form, more or less.
Yes.
I mean, you know.
And so all that said, you know, Alien 3, like so on, the game, everything like mm-hmm. that, you know. That all said, Zodiac was very subdued but still had incredible style. And I'll tell you the most incredible thing I think about, well, first of all, it's something I don't think I would normally like if another director might have done it or if someone else had written it. I'm not sure who actually... did the screenplay, but it was set up in a way so that, you know, it follows a number of characters,
mm-hmm.
and you kind of only fleetingly get to meet these people, and it kind of jumps in. It doesn't give you backstory on people, but it jumps in, and certain people have their quirks and so forth. Mark Ruffalo's character is one of the detectives that's assigned to, you know, the case, and he doesn't eat anything while he's out except for animal crackers. And his partner, Anthony Edwards from ER, or whatever Edwards, Anthony Edwards, John Edwards.
Anthony Edwards,
yeah,
the glasses,
yeah.
The balding
yeah,
guy?
Yeah, he has a wig in this, but
okay.
A very bad wig, too, actually.
Very 70s.
The wiggery
wasn't.
Because
it's set in the 70s, right?
It was,
it's
yeah.
About the
I think
Zodiac
they might have used
killings.
A wig from the 70s and a wig maker from the 70s as well. but he's every time he gets in the car with him, he says, animal crackers are in the trunk, or her, or he hands him a box of animal crackers. And it kind of goes on. He gets another partner later on, and he says, "Do you have any animal crackers?" And the guy's like, "What?" You know, so like just weird, you know, weird little things that kind of let you know about, like, you know, this cop, not only does he become obsessed, but he has that sort of obsessive thing already inside him because he's, you know, obsessed with animal crackers. For
regimented
instance.
About
yeah,
things
it,
he does.
It gives you yeah, you know. So I think it was really well set up. You were saying before I watched it, you know, hey, I'm going to wait for the special 2-disc edition that's coming out. And I told you, I think I said verbatim, you know, I don't care about that stuff. I just want to watch it unless they incorporate extra stuff into it. After I watched it, I was reading about it, and they said they do incorporate extra stuff into it. And apparently this one was just put out because the studio was pretty much said, listen, you got to put it out, like, now. And so they cut together a really quick, I guess it might even be different from what you saw in the theater.
That's too bad for them. But, I mean, I hope they don't cut the animal cracker stuff out of the director's version. No, that's kind of what I meant. Is I think for DVDs, I'm more inclined to sit and watch, like, a four-hour cut of something because I can pause it. I can go take,
oh, know, absolutely.
Take, go to the
sure,
bathroom.
Sure, sure.
I can take a walk. In theaters, I really don't like to be there for much longer than about 2 hours and 15 minutes as a max because I'm going to get antsy and I'm
right.
going to get, like, I don't want to be in that room anymore.
Well, The thing about this, you know, it was very, very well done. You actually do end up caring about the characters, getting a great deal. And there's a great deal of suspense in the entire film, even when it's not in a scene which are really strangely almost not intense, where the killer, like there's this, the one you were talking about where the scene where there's this couple in the park,
mm-hmm.
or a kind of like maybe it was, I don't remember what park it was, but it was overlooking a lake or something like that. And the guy just kind of walks up to them. In the part, and it's done in a really creepy way, but then it's
yeah.
like
I'm totally
you know.
Looking forward to watching.
Yeah,
it. No, I mean, for when I saw the trailers for it, I thought good because I think I didn't care for Panic Room because I think Fincher was having too much fun with digital stuff. I mean, he did a lot of that in Fight Club, but it was sort of like for the purposes of parody, like
almost,
you know
yeah.
when he's walking through the catalog or when you see him throw something into the trash bin and then they do an extreme zoom
right.
in. But it seemed like what Fincher was going for was sort of, he was trying to sort of do like an homage to Hitchcock in
it was,
Panic Room.
It was Hitchcockian, but
I mean,
it didn't work
the credit,
that way.
The same credit sequence as yeah. North by Northwest where the things kind of fit the buildings.
Right.
And then he did like a lot of visual things, sweeping through stuff that you wouldn't be able to do without digital
right.
technology. And
right, right. He went through
it kind of took me out of the movie.
The slats of the back of a
yeah.
chair and then through the handle of a teapot, like all the way through the
and,
window.
And
it
really reminded me of like, I guess he just recently, or not recently, but a couple years ago did a music video for the band Nine Inch Nails, which wasn't really that interesting but had some interesting aspects to it. And it was kind of like, well, what is he experimenting in this weird minimalism? And the video that he had done before for Perfect Circle I thought was really cool. I really enjoyed that video, but it was all sort of silhouettes. And so I think for me, Fincher at his best visually is probably something like The Game. And that's to me, that's because it's so stripped down. It's still very stylized, but it's so pristine.
Mm-hmm.
Everything about it is very pristine. It looks like a car commercial, like quality of visuals for a two-hour movie. And so when I saw the trailers for Zodiac, I thought, well, he's kind of getting back to not being so stuck on doing like a lot of digital things or visual things
yeah.
like that. I mean, I'm sure that they do a lot of digital stuff for like, you know, I think the World Trade Center is being built at the time, and so they probably have that in the background somewhere. Not the World Trade Center, I apologize. The Trans-American Building,
okay.
'cause it's set in San Francisco
right.
In the 70s. And it's a period movie, so there you go.
There's a scene actually where it shows it like in the middle, and it kind of goes into a musical sequence, and it shows.
Yeah, isn't that the opening of the movie? Isn't that how
it's in the middle?
Oh, it's in the middle.
Yeah,
weird.
They must have. You might have seen that in the trailer and thought that or something.
No,
like that,
I just read it was
oh,
reading
really?
About the
yeah.
The building.
I thought of you when you said it because when it happened because we did a thing in a class where you had to write something and you mentioned that
yeah.
in a little like it would be like a Mobisode type thing on
mm-hmm.
a cell phone. Here's the most incredible thing about the film. You know, I don't really talk too much about it. It's a true story. If I said anything, I wouldn't give it away because it's basically really based on the guy's book. The guy who Gyllenhaal plays, you know, he wrote a book of his whole experience. He was a cartoonist for either the Chronicle or the Examiner, I think the Chronicle,
mm-hmm.
and kind of got obsessed with the. Well,
he gets involved because he's acting. He's not just a cartoonist, right? He also ends up the police bring him in to do like.
The police don't bring him in. He does it on his own.
He starts
hassling them.
Drawing of what the guy might look like or something.
No, he copies down the first day that the first letter is sent into the paper. He copies down the code and gets obsessed with that because he made these ciphers.
Okay.
And they were different each time, and
Weird.
So he basically just kind of becomes his own personal quest to find out who it is.
And it has very little to do with the fact that he's associated with, like, a newspaper at all, because he's a cartoonist.
Yeah, he was there. Great acting. Robert Downey Jr. is fantastic in it. Really good.
Now, what role does he fit? Because Mark Ruffalo is the police.
Is the cop. Robert Downey Jr. was the crime scene writer for the Chronicle.
Okay, so he's the legitimate journalist.
Gyllenhaal kind of follows him around, but he's an alcoholic, and he just kind of dicks around the whole time. And he's serious about it, but he's mostly trying to, you know, increase his prestige and so forth by covering this and following new leads that he kind of makes up and so forth. But you know, so it's all based on that. It was very well done, and I think that it's probably Fincher's best just dramatic tale. It lacks a lot of the things, you know, of course it lacks real resolution, and it lacks, the climax seemed very forced to me, or the suspense part of the climax in the, like, you know, kind of the end of the third act type thing, seemed a little bit forced. And it, when you see it, you'll know why. But the most incredible thing about it was, and this is a very technical thing, was that there's this, it's a camera called the Thompson Viper.
Okay.
It's a digital. This movie was shot digitally. And this camera was first used in a British film and, let's see, Collateral and Miami Vice by Michael Mann, both shot of it, but in a condensed format, in a compressed format, and then transferred to, like, a HD cam or something like that for the whole Telecine type thing. But this was the first film to be shot completely uncompressed on it, and it looks beautiful. And this is the thing that Lucas and Spielberg and Scorsese were talking about 10, 15 years ago when they were talking about digital films
being able
to look like film, and because it's got all the same filters. In a few really bright daylight scenes, you can tell this is digital. You can tell with emotion.
But we're getting more acclimated to it, because, I mean, Collateral and Miami Vice especially had that going for them. I'd like to relate this. You talked about feeling like you're in the space while watching Zodiac. Like, Fincher's good at that. Michael Mann is fantastic at that. If you've seen Heat, if you've seen Collateral, but in Miami Vice also. I mean, and I, you know, because I'm such, I just don't get out to the theaters as often as I should. Haven't seen any of those movies at the theater. I saw Collateral at the theater, and I remember you really feel immersed in the actual environment. Like, in
it feels
Los
like
Angeles.
You're standing
it feels
outside.
Like you're there.
It
yeah.
looks like you're standing outside.
It feels like you're standing outside.
There's something else about it, about the digital thing, especially with Collateral and Miami Vice, because of that compressed format, is that it feels like, even without you feeling like you're there, it feels like you're watching video, and video by nature
has a greater documentary
looks
feel.
Like exactly like this is something that just really happened. If it's film, it looks beautiful and unreal.
Yeah, it's sort of a Dogma 95 effect.
Totally.
Is that you start getting a greater sense of
and the thing about this camera, the Thompson Viper, is it can register extremely low levels of light. And so for Collateral and Miami Vice,
they just use practical lighting.
Pretty much, almost completely. They said they use very little supplemental lighting whatsoever. But this with the uncompressed form, it looks beautiful, and everything except for one or two shots in brighter light, I had no idea. Three quarters of the way through the film, I said, wait a minute, this is digital, because I saw this one scene where Gyllenhaal gets out of a cab outside and looks up at a building and walks across the street, and you see as he moves a little bit, like, it's a digital. You can tell. The rest of the film, it just looked gorgeous. And it didn't have the, you know, it didn't look like 28 Days Later or something like that. It looked like, you know, it wasn't like little skips in motion.
No, I know what you mean from the trailers, I can tell.
Yeah, the ghosting. So it was just beautiful. And I think this is like, has to be a turning point in digital cinema. It has to be because, you know, I know Fincher is really kind of, he's not like the average person when it comes to style. So he is kind of going above and beyond the bounds of where.
No, he's the kind of person that if he's shooting digital.
Yeah,
I
absolutely.
Remember hearing that, like, he would have the film treated for, like, movies like Seven or The Game in such a way that it would bring the darks would be, like, the blacks would be blacker.
Yeah.
In the image quality. And so you can see that in The Game. And so he's like a stickler for that kind of stuff.
Yep.
You can just tell that he's a very technical visual guy, which is why the commentaries for him are usually worth listening to. So I'll look forward to watching that.
I highly recommend it for, you know, especially that reason. It's just a good dramatic film as well, and I think it has a lot of suspense in it. I think it also kind of shows a development in Fincher's part, because so far the stuff he's done has been kind of systematically, you know, something that's meant to, it's almost like watching like Fox TV. It's something that's meant to provoke a reaction. It's either like, you know, like watching like World's.
They've all been like fun movies, I think, is how I would
describe
it.
They have been, but they've been something that people who are watching, you know, an older critic is going to watch and say, oh, this is mindless, stylish, sharp, contrasty, action-packed, violent, fluff, basically. Because it's like this, you know, it's not even popcorn stuff, because I don't think anything he's made has done super well. Box office. Fight Club made like 60 or 70 or something like that, and it cost like 90 or 80 to make. I think Alien 3 might have made the highest gross of everything he did, but that was just because it was an Alien franchise. I could be wrong about that.
I bet 7 probably ended up pretty well in the long run.
But yeah, you know, I think that was... I'm actually glad I watched it the other night, because I think that was really eye-opening to me just to watch. There is something that's out right now that I think that I really want to see that fits something I want to talk about, which is... it's almost a new genre, a subgenre, I'll call it, of action films, especially. And it's kind of taking over where, for a while, the only thing you can count on as action was PG-13 stuff and things like The Matrix, science fiction-y type things, which is this this movie, Shoot 'Em Up, is part of. And it's this self-parodying action film where... It's meant to go so over the top, and I do believe this is a very recent thing, because Running Scared, Crank, Hot Fuzz was a little too self-parodying to be.
Was it self-parodying?
It was meant to be like that. Running Scared and Crank are not comedies, though they do have a couple of. And the Shoot 'Em Up is supposed to be even more over the top than those. I think.
Are you doing that because you're looking at the trailers and you're thinking, well, why would Clive Owen and Paul Giamatti be in this movie?
No. I read some. reviews that when I first saw the thing about it, I thought it doesn't look that good. I read the reviews and they basically all sound exactly like reviews I read for Running Scared and Crank before I watched them both and enjoyed them both. I think Running Scared was a little better stylistically.
So it's getting like negative reviews that you can sort of
not necessarily
pick the good bits out of.
Here's the type of reviews that it's getting, which is really kind of it would be disheartening if you cared about the substance of where films are going morally. But here's what it is: it's so violent and so over the top and so fun to watch this bloody balletic thing that has ultimately no point and is worthless human, worthless to all humankind. And they're like, I feel ashamed, but I greatly enjoyed this. That's the basic, line that runs between all these films. And I love them. I think they're fantastic. I think that, what was that, stupid Aces one that just came out with,
Smoking Aces.
I think that falls into there, but that one was supposed to be so stupid that it doesn't even work.
Oh.
I haven't seen that one.
I haven't either.
My brother did. He said it was lame.
I can get a kick out of those.
Did you see either Running Scared or
No,
Crank?
I didn't see Running Scared or any of that. But I mean, I think another movie that you'd fall into that category is something like that Domino movie that everybody objected to.
Domino was...
Because it was like an action crazy shoot 'em up movie,
right? It wasn't that action crazy, though. It was supposedly the pseudo-biopic thing. And Tony Scott did the thing where he just went way too overboard with the filters and the cuts. The cuts are ridiculous, and there's this ridiculous editing going on.
But that isn't like sort of self-parodying, you don't think?
No. It was all Tony Scott's films. I mean, if it was, it was parodying his own films.
Yeah, exactly. But that's what I thought when I looked at it.
But that wouldn't make sense, because it sucked and everyone hated it. And like, he must have known that. Man on Fire before...
I thought it was sort of the same thing as that.
Was like building up to that, and by the halfway through that film, I was like, such a headache, because the cuts were just like, and then like it was these super bright yellow shots.
Yeah, it was really
constant, shaky, just terrible. And then he did that Deja Vu film after Domino with Denzel. That one was enjoyable, but he was slowing down. He kind of reached a peak with Domino with this style. And then started kind of going back down the hill and slowing down and getting into more story and stuff like that.
So how many of these parody action movies do you think they can make? Because, like, we just talked about some you thought didn't – one you thought didn't work, or two you thought didn't work. I mean, no, you haven't seen Smokin' Aces, but you saw Domino,
I assume it doesn't work. Domino was terrible.
I didn't mind it. I actually was able to watch all of it. Usually I
– I honestly don't know if that fits into it, because if you see Running Scared and Crank, you'll know what I mean by –
But those are action movies that, like, don't... It sounds like we're getting into this whole, like, so bad it's good thing again.
It is a so bad it's good thing, but it's not, like...
And usually that doesn't work if they're doing it on purpose. Like, we talked about the Leprechaun movies.
That's the thing. I don't think these guys do it, because when you read...
But do you think that Shoot 'Em Up is doing it on purpose?
No.
Because and you think that people like Giamatti and Owen are in this movie with total tongue-in-cheek to the way that the kind of characters
Giamatti's got to be. Apparently he has a blast with this and just goes nuts. And apparently he has a line that somebody says where somebody talks about killing a bunch of people, and he said, Giamatti says, well, I'm happy to do that. Then he says, plus violence is just fun to watch. And like they said, like he almost like says it to the camera when it happens. Like it's like, you know, hey.
And then, I mean, come on, it's got to be just known.
With him, but they said that this filmmaker is this guy who's been trying to get this made for a little while, and he ended up borrowing some money to make a short film and then using a few scenes of what he wanted this to look like, and then using that to show how over the top and ridiculous this action and violence was. And this guy is just like, the people who direct these films, Running Scared, Crank, and so forth, are guys who are like, dude, I got the most awesome idea. And they're super excited. This guy's going to, and you know, they go into the pitch like doing all the, like, yeah, you know, I'm going to go behind my back and shoot this way. And then he's going to jump in the air and shoot between his legs. And he's going to shoot underneath a toilet. And a car's going to explode. And he's going to fly out the middle of it. But he's okay because he was wearing a flak jacket. And just keeps, you know, these guys are... I guarantee you, these filmmakers are totally 100% believing into this thing.
They're geeking out on the action.
As like, this is the greatest thing. This is going to be the best thing ever made.
Because you got to hope that one out of every 18 of those is actually going to work and be awesome.
Oh, totally.
It's going to be the whole Cowboy Bebop thing, where it's like, there's awesome fight scenes that are kind of ridiculous, but the rest of it's actually cool. And in the context of those awesome fight scenes, you don't sit there and go, this is dumb and ridiculous, and laugh at it. You go, this is freaking cool.
Yeah. And I think that...
He shot that guy in the head.
Right.
I didn't expect him to shoot somebody in the head.
I just think that this is, you know, it's got the right tone for this sort of thing, because, you know, the 80s, 90s action movies that we always talk about, they took themselves very seriously, even though there were really ironic and... Well, that's the thing, is that there was lack of irony when they said the really terrible lines and punchlines.
The Schwarzenegger things were
more jokey. You take those away, anytime someone says some stupid thing before shooting someone in an 80s or 90s action film, it's supposed to be like, this is badass, you know? Like, the screenwriter or director was like, this is awesome. I mean, I'm going to get some Hollywood tail and $1 million for this.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wonder also where this is heading, because when movies inside a subgenre kind of try to top each other, eventually it's going to reach some sort of zenith.
Critical mass, if you will.
Yeah, and then, like, you know, for instance, with the torture porn films, you get to Hostel, and you're like, you know, that's, you know, and very critically acclaimed, and everyone loved it, and so forth. And then after that, you're like, that's it. A few more come out. One of them tries to be even worse, which is that Captivity one.
Mm-hmm.
And people are just like, I'm done. It's no more, you know? I gotta stop and say right here, I think your refrigerator might be the only one in the world that has both Ruby Red Squirt and O'Doul's in it.
It's very likely. I've got the digital camera. I can include a picture of the fridge.
You probably should.
In the show notes.
Yeah, put the Ruby Red Squirt right next to the O'Doul's. And then one of the other strange drinks that are in there. There's a really eclectic collection
Indeed.
Of drinks inside that refrigerator there.
Okay, do you want to move on to one of our special segments?
Sure. Which one do you want to do?
Well, I think we should save the... Do you think that we should do the contest part last?
Oh, of course, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so
we'll
let's
do that when we're winding down.
You had two of them, and then did I have a third idea? I don't remember my third idea right now, though. So we've done a review, and that's good. And we talked about what we'd watch. Those are all two kind of segments. So do you want to do the talk about where we each discuss we sort of defend a movie that is not, in some cases, might be critically acclaimed, but is not popularly acclaimed, or might be.
Yeah.
But by and large, the key is that it's not popular.
I prefer calling it just a segment called like weird movies or something like that. Something that you can't just look at and say, oh, this is an action film. Oh, this is a science fiction. Whatever. It's something that's generally
defending the esoteric. That's
sure,
what you
sure.
call it. That's
yeah,
our segment.
It's not even. I mean, but it doesn't even have to be an esoteric film. It can be. You know, you could be defending.
Yeah, but we can overuse it like people overuse Kafkask.
Okay.
So you start.
Okay, I'm not gonna go into great detail here, but
you got to defend it.
I'm not. I'm not going to go into great detail defending it, though, because I'm not going to point out specifics, because I'm going to name two movies here that I haven't seen in years, both, but have still left a very positive impression on it. Yeah, on me. I found it, you know, strangely endearing.
Okay.
One of them was The Island of Dr. Moreau, the more recent one.
94, I think.
Yeah. Val Kilmer at his most over the top, if you can believe that, because he's usually at the most over the top in half the movies he's in.
Same with, what's his name? Brando.
Brando. Brando's, yeah, this might have been the point where everyone realized how crazy Brando was.
Well, I remember Kilmer was on Inside the Actors Studio talking about how him and Brando were essentially just, I don't know, maybe they're the kind of actors that don't take certain types of subject matter seriously enough to even bother to take it seriously, so they just decide to go over the top with it.
I was just reading a review of The Island of Dr. Moreau, and this guy said that you could see Brando handing the mantle of craziest actor alive to Kilmer halfway through the film, because Kilmer has the most outrageous performance, I think, of any Kilmer film I've seen, and he really... he really just goes nuts in it. And there's these nice little touches and scenes where he, not nice, but they're actually quite terrible. David Thewlis is the kind of protagonist, the everyman who's a British guy stuck on a life raft who gets picked up by Kilmer, who's going to the island. And at one point, Kilmer is holding this bunny rabbit. I don't have to say bunny rabbit. I can just say rabbit. But for some reason, bunny rabbit makes it... Bunny rabbit sounds softer. And
kill the rabbit.
Yeah.
So
he's holding this rabbit, and he's petting it, and he holds it out toward Thewlis like he wants it to kiss it. He wants Thewlis to kiss it. And then he breaks the rabbit's neck and you know, feeds it to someone or uses it for an experiment or something like that. It's been a while. But you know, he's just like this. He's kind of a supporting character because the main guy is Thewlis.
Mm-hmm.
The big, you know, the person that the movie's about and everything, that the subject matter is...
The antagonist.
Is Dr. Moreau.
Otherwise known as Alphonse Mephisto.
Yeah. And his, what was his little guy's name? Kevin? Was it Kevin or David? It was Kevin?
It was Kevin.
And, of course, which was also the, in this movie, it's where they got Mini-Me from, was this guy who followed him around. Wearing the same clothes, too.
He wore the sun hat. And playing a mini piano and everything.
Exactly. And it's just got, you know, in 94, so I was 14, and I think I was like, this is, you know, just awesome. I think that I'm really excited by this film, and it has everyone has handguns in it. Everyone has handguns. Then toward the very end of it, all the manimals, the man animal things, the leopard guy and the tiger guy and the cheetah guy and whoever else, and they all start getting their hands on the guns since they're running around shooting each other. They figure out how to shoot, and then they kind of, you know, of course. I don't know if it's some sort of social commentary. You put guns in the hands of animals, and they know how to use them instantly.
It's maybe when they're the man inside knows
the man
is
inside,
more of an animal
than
the animal, maybe.
But it's just, you know, it's and it was John. You know, I've always liked John Frankenheimer. I've always liked Ronin is one of my favorite films.
Okay.
French Connection 2, I don't know. You know, it's not like he has this like some long thing of really great films or anything, but...
Frankenheimer's done some really
good
ones.
I like Frankenheimer stuff.
But he never seemed like he was much of an auteur.
Kind of be like
Brett Ratner is.
Ronan really was, I believe, brilliant. That might have more to do with the fact that David Mamet actually...
wrote it.
Yeah, which I think under a pseudonym also, but...
Well, I remember it being marketed as David Mamet writing.
Really?
I remember it has his
fake name as the writer.
Oh.
Because I think he was unhappy with a rewrite or something that happened.
Possibly.
You know, I don't know. I don't know if I've really defended it here. I've kind of just pointed out how stupid it is in parts. But I felt it like, I don't know, there's just something about...
It's based on literature, right?
Oh, it is. It's H.G. Wells' thing, yeah. And I read the H.G. Wells.
The
source material. And it was similar in parts and different in other parts. And, of course, it was set a long time ago. And this one was kind of set in modern times.
It's got the most dangerous game aspect to it. The Island of the Hunt. Which then I'd like to bring up a relation to that. The Island of Dr. Moreau theme, I think, has been played through quite a few times in some of our favorite 80s and 90s cartoons. I remember an episode of G.I. Joe... where they were, like, making werewolves in Antarctica or something. Like, they had, like, Serpentor had this, like, biosphere. And there was something really creepy about that because it would show, it, like, was willing to show. Like, they had laser guns, so they couldn't have real guns because the sensors were too big on that. But they could show, like, Shipwreck get injected with some serum that turned him into a crazy monster creature. And I'm like, no, not the Shipwreck. And then even more, like, on the head is the episode of Batman the Animated Series called, it was called like Tiger Tiger.
Oh, sure.
It was based on the William Blake poem, but it had to do with Catwoman being captured by somebody who had engineered man animal things on an island, and Batman ended up being hunted by one of the guys. It was totally a combination of Dr. Moreau in The Most Dangerous Game.
They also did that with one of the early comics from the animated series, the Batman Adventures, that one.
They probably just
what they did was they did the Mad Hatter, and then he had his own it wasn't an island, but it was like in his cage like zoo area, and he had a whole bunch of engineered, or they might have been robots. I don't remember.
It could have just been that he was mind controlling the animals and getting them to act humanoid.
It wasn't just animals though. It was like weird genetically engineered and or robotic
freakiness
things that were attacking him, and Batman was having to beat them up. It might have been one of the cartoons also, actually, because they did that a few times. They kind of copied them.
Yeah, like I said, that structure happens a lot in that concept of the man animal. A dichotomy of our nature.
I think what struck me about it was the potential even back then, because I still think that it has like great potential to not necessarily say something, but just be good drama. Like I honestly, I like the movie and I enjoy it, and I think it's worth definitely a few watches. Without letting you attack it, I don't know if you were planning on doing that, but I'm just going to move on quickly to my next one because it also revolves around an island. So I'm just going to mention it really quickly, which was. No Escape, also from around the same time.
I was thinking about that. You know, the Ray Liotta, and it's a sci-fi prison thing.
Yeah. And it's hard to watch. I think maybe it didn't get the kind of audience it deserved. I know it didn't do super well in theaters, and I believe it did cost a little bit to make. They don't really do too much with the futuristic aspect. You see some at the very beginning.
It's really just the futuristic stuff. It's just to give them the excuse to create this scenario.
Yes, exactly. But
world, is it the world? It's like a continent on the world. So it's not, but it's conveyed like it's not super big because like
it's not super big. It's an island.
The warring groups are like within like a day's journey of each other.
Right. Yeah. Totally. And they keep him on the other side and so forth. And he gets dumped off there because. He kills his superior in either the army or the police because
it's the Marines, I think.
Yeah, he kills some kids or women or children or something like that,
It has a very iconic or very memorable opening sequence because they're all lined up, and then his commanding officer stance comes up.
That's
and he breaks ranks, walks right up to him, and shoots him in the head, point blank. And it's like it's shot with a lot of negative space. It's like white, and these characters walk on, and. Yeah, it was different. I remember I sat through it all, but as a kid, I was just looking for a good sci-fi movie.
Well, I really enjoy it, and I think the weird thing about it is that maybe one reason why it didn't get as much acclaim as it should have or whatever is that Ray Liotta does not look like an everyday man protagonist.
Well, Ray Liotta is so attached at this point even
to Goodfellas. I don't think not only Goodfellas, but if you've seen what's that one about when he plays the crazy cop and Kurt Russell and Unlawful Entry? Have you seen that one?
Yeah, that too.
So he's done a lot of movies and
it's hard to see him as a
Turbulence.
Protagonist.
Yeah, Turbulence. Like he's been in a lot of movies. Even if he plays a good guy in something, he'll play two in a row where he plays some crazy guy and generally a bad guy. If not, even in comedies, he plays someone who.
No, the casting there was a little difficult to get over to see Ray Liotta.
But I enjoy him, and I enjoy.
No, I do too.
I think he was good in the role. I just think that maybe people have that perception because I had an inkling of it in my mind the whole time. Because when he looks at someone, he's got these very clear eyes, and he just looks like I'm going to murder you. Like that's his look. He's like somebody says something to you, and he looks at you. If I met Ray Liotta in real life and I said, like, hey, how's it going? He just stared at me. I would think that he was just going to stab me in the throat or something like that.
And probably find a way to be justified.
Sure. What did you say about my mother? I don't even know her.
I remembered liking the movie because, like you said, it's another island situation, so you're trapped. But it's a prison thing, so there's that whole aspect of controlling them. And, I mean, I don't know how far you've gotten through Outlaw Star, that anime that I loaned you.
Yeah, it's still the same.
But there's an episode towards the end where he ends up on a prison planet that's got, like, 5 times Earth's gravity, and that's just kind of cool. So things like that, like I said, I put it in my list of things I like. Airships and trains and snow. But is there anything else you want to say about it?
No, that was it.
Okay, I'm going to start with one that I like, and that's easy. And I don't know if I'll be able to relate this thematically to anything else. But Steven Spielberg's 1941. I actually like that movie. I saw that movie when I was really little. Like, it was one of the first times I was allowed to stay up till midnight to watch, you know, for on New Year's Eve.
Right.
And we watched that movie, and then we watched, like, Johnny Carson, and then it was New Year's Eve, and it was like, hooray! And I felt like, wow, I can't imagine ever staying up this late. Like, this is crazy, you know? Like, it's like the world is in a different mode at this point. And it is at midnight if you... No, we lose appreciation for that as we get older, that fact that at certain hours, it's like its own... It's like a completely different environment. But the thing I like about it as a movie, having seen it years ago, I've got a lot of nostalgia built up on it. I've seen, like, the first half of it recently, but... it's got some funny characters, but it's got one thing I just love in movies. I love it a lot in television shows and stuff. It works better in television shows. But is the ensemble cast and multiple storylines going on at the same time that kind of interweave, that generally end in sort of a big action set piece, you know, or something kind of crazy like that.
Right.
And so that movie's got it's just got a lot of craziness going on and a lot of humor. And it's a period movie, and I like that kind of period. I like the 40s. I have a lot of weird, and I guess there's a Japanese word for this, but it's sort of like nostalgia for time you haven't lived.
Okay.
For like, I have that hardcore for like the 60s and the jazzy bossa nova-y time period,
right?
There, you know. It's part of why I really like that Mad Men TV show, because it's just got that stylism to it, and I'm like, man, that stuff's awesome. So I mean, this one's like, it's 1941, so it's not 1962 or something, but it's still got some weird aspects. Like, I remember that Robert Stack plays this big general, and he's like crying while he's in the theater watching Dumbo, and John Belushi's in it as this crazy ace pilot guy who's just nuts, and Slim Pickens is in it as this this hick that gets picked up by the Japanese submarine that's trying to figure out how to bomb Los Angeles or something. Mm. And he's got like a Cracker Jack prize compass because their navigation goes out, and so he swallows it. And there's weird little shit like that going on. And I don't know if it's just like people just hate it because they don't like the movie or what, but you know, they hate it because they don't like the movie. Wow. Or if everyone just hears that it's not good and doesn't like it, or if there's
honestly,
some sense of sentimentality.
That's the it's the one Spielberg film I've never seen.
Well, yeah, cool, but It's all right. It's like a fun. I would put it like in this category of a fun Saturday night movie that you can watch with like, you could watch it with your parents. You could watch it with your kids if you are a parent. It's like but it's not like family friendly, like generic family friendly. It's just like a fun movie,
right?
To watch with a lot of stuff happening in it, and that's how I like some of my movies every now and again. Is I like craziness and a lot of storylines, and because then you can pick and choose, you know. You're not married to one theme and one idea and one set of protagonist-antagonist relationship that you like either have to like or not like. You can kind of, like, oh, what's going to happen with that next one? I'm more interested in that storyline. Then go back to the other storyline. You're like, oh, now this one's getting good.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to do another one that is actually probably considered good. And I just put it on there thinking, well, I don't think I hear about it as much as I should. And it was a comedy in the 80s that starred one Mr. Kurt Russell, who was awesome. And his current, I don't know if she's actually his wife or if they're just, like, in a perpetual, like,
common law thing. Yeah.
But Goldie Hawn, and it's called Overboard. And it's a really good comedy. I really just enjoyed it. It's got Mona from Who's the Boss?
Who's the Boss, yeah.
And her dog, Chitaki.
Also from Brazil.
Yeah. And, oh, that's right, she was in Brazil. She was good in Brazil. And it's about how... this rich lady that's all unhappy but kind of very stuck up ends up falling overboard and getting amnesia, and Kurt Russell is a guy that she'd hired to do some carpentry work for to like make her super big shoe closet even more super big in the confines of this yacht. That's why it's called Overboard. It has a mild
right.
nautical theme. And he ends up somehow finding out that she's got amnesia, and he goes and he convinces her that she's his wife because he's got, like, a dead wife and he's got, like, 15 kids. Mm. And the thing I remember about the movie is that the way it handles, like, these kids is actually pretty mature and pretty cool. Like, each kid kind of has their own personality. It's not just, like, it's a collection of kids and it's zaniness around the house and they're always getting into trouble. And then Kurt Russell's got his buddy and he's just kind of, like, working man. But he's got his dream to try and create a miniature golf. And so it's like something that isn't so epic and huge. It's
right.
just sort of, it's realizable, and he does get accomplish it, and it ends up becoming kind of a nice love story, and you kind of know where it's going to go. And it's sort of about you know, Money Can't Buy You Love and all that other kind of stuff. But I remember it just being like a pretty entertaining movie that was funny, like had a couple good laugh out loud moments. Primarily, I think Kurt Russell isn't used enough for his comedic sensibility and his comedic timing. If you've seen Big Trouble in Little China, you know what I'm talking about. That character of Jack Burton, I'm terribly remiss that John Carpenter and him haven't gotten together and done like more Jack Burton stories. Because if you know, the end of that movie totally lends itself to like a sequel, on some level at least. So Overboard with
I think
Kurt
Overboard.
Russell.
I'm going to attack this one a little bit because Overboard Great. Plays on TBS too many times to be something that's either overlooked, weird, or something that you feel like you have to defend.
Really?
TBS.
You don't think? Because TBS. TBS plays is the bastion of quality, right?
It's not a bastion of
the
quality.
The last time I saw it was on TBS, but it was years ago. I haven't been on TBS in years.
It still comes on TBS all the time.
Really?
Yeah. I think I might have seen it like a month ago on TBS.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. It's crazy. But, yeah, but when? Like at 3 a.m. when
you
were up?
Like, it was like 4 in the afternoon on a Saturday or something
weird.
Like that. When no one's watching TV.
Yeah.
So
you think it just doesn't count then? I got a list here. You want me to do another?
No, go ahead. If you want to do one more.
Or do you want to attack this movie from like more of its...
I think Overboard is one of those comedies that isn't funny and that...
It does have a lot of moments of more or less seriousness to it.
It's pretty much a kid's movie. It's got those adult moments in it, one or two, like usually sexual innuendo type mm-hmm. things. It's like, I don't know, it's something where if I had to choose between watching Overboard and
getting your wisdom teeth
listening
pulled.
To a filibuster by Strom Thurmond, who's dead now, isn't he?
I'll
listen to a filibuster from Strom Thurmond while dead, rather.
Like or on like C-SPAN Classic. Do they
sure.
have that yet?
C-SPAN Classic. What about C-SPAN 2 Classic, where you get to watch small city councils argue about...
Awesome. And then you get the Sklar brothers just like making
jokes about it
all the time, right?
The cheap seats or whatever that show's called.
That's what it's called. I mean, I'm not going to fold. I still think it's a good movie. It's a good blend for me because the drama doesn't feel super forced. It's kind of saccharine-y, but it's... I don't know. I liked it, and I thought that there are a couple funny moments in it, and there are some sort of good bits. Like the characters seem like his goal to want to do this or do that, and then the idea of sort of a family coming together and getting along, and they have problems within their group. And I don't know. I thought it was a good movie. We have the pitch segment.
We're gonna
and this
do
is your suggestion.
We're going to do a weekly film pitch.
And the gimmick about this is the only interactive thing we've come up with
interactive,
so far.
Interactive, completely,
and
100%.
Unlike a lot of podcasts that seem to like have plenty of extra junk to give away to people, I don't really have anything to give away.
We're going
to
take something from you.
But except, whatever. So the way this works is... that we each come up with a pitch for a given like theme or genre of a movie type, and in like 2 or 3 minutes we have to pitch it to you, our listeners, and then you can send us an email of which pitch you think is best, Zach's or mine, and I'm Ian, and you send those of course to the email address that's for this feudal podcast, which is ian.strope@gmail.com. And I'm inviting so much spam now. I can just feel the like giant torrent of it. It'll be like an abyss, that scene that was cut, but then added in the director's cut, and then inexplicably appears whenever it airs ad nauseum on USA, where it shows the giant wave that's about to crush the cities, and then it stops. I can just feel it's like that. So send those emails about which pitch you think is best each week, and then whoever wins, I don't know. You said like the other person should have to pay them a dollar, but like, what do the listeners give a shit about that? They probably don't give a shit.
So basically, it's a contest. If anyone even cares to do this, if one person writes in and chooses one over the other, they're the winner.
Exactly. So you could think of yourself as that one vote, that tipping vote,
because
it will matter. And it doesn't matter any other time.
Who we're
talking
to right now? You. You're the one listener.
That's
probably.
You.
So. You. You.
You are a beautiful and unique snowflake.
Yeah. Whatever. You. Do we even say that to, they have to prefer? They have to know objectively which one is
better. Yeah, you just say, like, Zach's is better or Ian's better.
Mine's
and in the, better. In the subject met line, just say, like, feudal podcast or about the podcast or pitch contest. Yes. Well, there's a lot of options there, and I'll probably look at it really carefully.
Okay, so since I threw down the gauntlet and I said that mine is going to be worse and more ridiculous than yours,
uh-huh.
You go ahead and okay. start. And so here's the thing. It's going
you
to
came
be,
up with the theme.
You got to go like I say at a most. I mean, it's going to be like a three-minute thing, so you got to get, you know, we'll try to time a little bit here. We probably won't be too successful with that.
Well, there's clocks on both
the
these computers.
The theme is period action film.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead.
Okay, go. I made notes here, so... I don't know. Oh, God, this is awful. Okay, so mine is a... I was just inspired... Oh, I saw The Incredibles, and I really liked that movie. That was one of the...
You're wasting time here, man.
Okay. CG. It's a CG kids action movie, because they don't make a lot of those anymore.
You've
they don't
already
make a
lost.
Lot of kid movies.
You've already lost.
You think so? I think so. See, you thought you'd lose.
Oh,
and
man.
And it's called Time Striker.
Okay.
And it's about a little kid...
Strike 2.
Okay, it's about a kid who finds this book of old matches... And the matches are maybe like 3 inches long with little weird incrementations on them. And they're actually, every time you strike one of the matches, it opens a portal to time. As the match burns down, it gets closer and closer to the present. So like if you struck it and then jumped in, it would be, I don't know, like the Cretaceous period or something.
Right.
If you struck it and let it burn like a third of the way down, it might be like, I don't know, it might be like Rome or Egypt or something. And basically, the whole inciting event is that this kid's grandfather disappears. And after a couple of months, they think that he's dead. So the kid ends up like in the attic and finds these matches and a little note. And then he ends up searching for his grandpa through time. And what happens is he ends up – okay, things I've got, different periods. He ends up in Rome, in ancient Rome. He ends up during the Spanish Inquisition in the Old West. And in parentheses, I put Deadwood just to give myself a sense of what kind of Old West I'm looking for. So this will be a kid's CG movie, but it will have a lot of bleeps in it.
Okay.
So that's I'm actually have
okay.
the swearing
I like
in it,
that.
But with the bleeps.
Sure.
So it'll be like a lot of deed sucker, like all over the place, just all over the place. He eventually finds his grandpa, and then they end up working together.
What's this going to be rated? What would you hope the MPAA would reach?
I'm thinking that they'll give it a tenuous PG.
Tenuous PG.
Or possibly a PG-13, okay. And people will be like, "Whoa!" And that'll be the spark. Okay, he ends up in Victorian England.
You got 2 minutes, by the way.
Yeah, he ends up in Victorian England because I want to go with a steampunk element there for
okay.
sure. And then I put dot, dot, dot for the final one, and I wrote dinosaurs.
Okay.
And
dot, dot,
most
dot,
people,
dinosaurs.
Most people really hate dinosaurs. But anyway, yeah, the kid, I want to give the kid a really stupid name, inspired once
I'm
more.
I'm sure you would.
By Brad Bird in his movies. So I'm going to call my kid Grigalt, who, if you pay any attention to Kids in the Hall, will know is
yeah.
one of the characters in this Bruce McCullough sketch where they're shoveling coal. So Grigalt's looking for his grandfather, who left him the matches and instructions about how the matches work.
You better hurry up here because I'm going to ask you. I'm going to ask you who's playing. Who do you got? Who you got in mind?
You got for cast?
Who do you want to cast? Hurry.
Okay. For gosh, it's just some kid. I think I'm going to go for a fresh face for the kid. Some no known kid. He doesn't need to have glasses. I don't want him to look like Harry Potter. I don't want him to be particularly punk like or like anything stupid like that. But he is a kid, so I would say probably like around 12. I wouldn't cast like an 18-year-old to play a 16-year-old in this. That's not what I'm going for. It's actually like a kid, so I'm going to play it like a kid. For the grandpa, I don't know. And I even thought, since I said it's a CG, it's all about voices. And I think visually I see it as being kind of a mix between The Incredibles, the look of that, the Tezuka version of Metropolis. Because I imagine the grandpa having like one of those big, huge Tezuka noses, like from Astro Boy.
Sure.
And it's smoking a pipe. So it'll probably be rated R because it'll have smoking in it.
That's
but
right.
The grandpa smokes a pipe.
You can't have smoking anymore.
And
if you have it set in a certain time period, then it's okay, I think.
Well,
if it's context.
He'll be smoking the pipe like during Victorian England times or something.
Mine is untitled, so I'm going to throw that out right there. I don't have a name. I'm sure.
Okay.
So if anyone votes for mine, they can always they can suggest a name as well. Okay, so are you ready to time me? It's gonna be really quick.
How many minutes do you get?
Oh,
three.
Say three.
How many did you give me?
I gave you like four.
Okay, well then I'll give you four.
Okay.
You got it. Go.
Here it is. This is also a little bit of a biopic, but it changes it, the biopic. Okay. Isaac Newton.
Mm-hmm.
16, let's say 80, around
okay.
there. Maybe 1690.
He's done most of his calculus.
Sure, he's done all that crap. He already, you know, apple dropped in his head, all that garbage. Which didn't actually happen at all.
No.
Okay. Isaac Newton decides he's sick of science and he wants to just catch counterfeiters, right?
Wow, I feel good.
This really happened. He really did try to catch. He hung out in bars in like costumes and decided he was going to catch counterfeiters. And he did this.
You're so full of
shit. I swear to you. I read a thing about Isaac Newton that this actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't like do it as a hobby. He was like serious about it because he had a problem with like counterfeiters was like high treason. I'm getting into this. I shouldn't. Okay, the pitch is this. Isaac Newton, who's by the way played by Gary Busey, because I think he would look great in a huge powdered wig. Right?
He doesn't even need it. He just dyes his hair blonde.
No.
Gray.
Big, long, powdered wig. You're not getting me. Okay. Huge. Like a volcano coming out of his head.
Okay.
Gary Busey. He's Isaac Newton. He decides he's you know, the science crap isn't, you know, it's run its course. Who cares about
this?
Yeah. He wants some action. He's getting up there in age. He's in his 50s. I don't know how old he is. I don't know. 40s? Who knows? I don't know when he was born. The 1620s. So he decides he's going to go after these counterfeiters. He starts hanging out with these guys in the bar, and William Challoner, I think, was the guy's actual name. But this guy was the biggest counterfeiter. He ends up trying to get involved with him and trying to find this guy out and find out what's going on, minting.
This is
going to
turn into a Point Break storyline, isn't it?
Almost. So he gets involved, and then William Challoner finds out that he's actually Isaac Newton. And he kills Isaac Newton's entire family, slaughters them, slits their throats.
All Kaiser Soze style.
Yeah, yeah. And Newton goes nuts. He gets he brings along his slave girl, this black girl, and he falls in love with her, by the way, through the course. That's a love interest. And then his crazy, wacky sidekick guy, played by, Paul Rubens. And they basically chase Challoner finally out. Throughout France, and they go across the channel and go through France, and they end up in some
like the Gobi Desert in China.
They end up in like a North German like swamp, and there's this huge action shootout. Everyone's shooting each other, everyone's trying to kill these guys. They all have like they had guns back then, right?
It's kind of inconsequential. They probably had guns.
It's the year 2043, and Isaac Newton, played by Gary Busey, they end up going to this big cliff, and at the end, Isaac Newton's gun is empty. The sidekick has been shot. He's mortally wounded. He's not dead yet, though. Kind of the Rob Schneider thing. I'm not Judge Dredd. I'm not quite dead. I'll be all right. He gets Challoner on the edge of this cliff, and Challoner has backed up really far, but then he hears the click of Newton's gun. Nothing happens, and so Challoner raises his gun and says, "This is it. You've had it." And Newton says, "You're forgetting one thing. Gravity." And the cliff goes and crumbles, and he goes, "Wah!" for no reason. I guess he could throw something at the edge of the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
He had an apple in his pocket. That's what he was going to eat.
Yeah.
He kind of rolls it at him, and it puts a little too much weight on the edge of the cliff, and the guy falls to his death. And maybe at the end it could show something impale the guy's head, come through his eye, his ear, something like that, and you know, kind of like Blood Rain, because I want everything I make to be kind of like Blood Rain. And here's the greatest thing. Tons of gratuitous nudity, sex, violence, anachronistic
language. Okay, well, would accommodate that when the guy kills Isaac Newton's family? Does he like rape his like family?
No, rape. No, that's terrible. How could you suggest such a thing? Here's the greatest thing.
Just saying, you wanted violence and nudity.
Here's the greatest thing.
That's
it'll
a
be,
good combination.
It'll be rated G.
How's that?
I'll find a way.
You'll find a way.
Okay, so obviously I win. So
well, we'll see.
You owe me $100.
We have listeners. They're going to vote. And that was Zach's idea, the untitled Isaac Newton Project, and mine is Time Striker.
Time Striker.
The CG children animation. STRYKKER. So send your votes.
TYMESTRYKKYR.
Actually, no, I'm going to use it like a seasoning.
You could incorporate that the kid is a cook, a part-time cook, and he uses, you know, time and everything.
Well, he's learning to cook, yeah.
Yeah, learning to cook. He's an apprentice cook
to
Wilford Brimley. Is he still alive? Yeah, he is. He does the diabetes commercials.
Diabetes.
You have to say it like that, too. Diabetes.
Because that's how Wilford Brimley says it.
People have the right to hear that if they want to. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
If they don't want to hear a certain thing, the one person listening can email you and tell them that they'd rather hear us talk about
other things, yeah. We're open to suggestions, and we're open for criticism. That's what we want.
Anyway.
Hate mail.
Yeah, you know, the Newton counterfeiter thing, he got a bunch of people to hang because they hung counterfeiters, and Isaac Newton was personally responsible for the deaths of many people just trying to put food in their family's mouths by counterfeiting.
Wow.
Terrible man.
And it plus...
What he accomplished in science, you know, does not cover the sins he...
That's not sins. He even followed the law, man. I am the law. Thank you. I can tell that story about the bees again because it didn't get recorded properly.
No, let's not talk about the bees.
Oh, man, but that was so awesome.
Wait, what was the story?
Remember about how you used the potato gun on the bees?
Are you sure it wasn't a wasp thing?
It was like a wasp thing.
Yeah, you talked about that.
Hit it with the potato gun, that was that.
Gosh, man, your crowning achievement.
I know.
Of manhood.
I know.
That was when you showed... Yeah, that was when you were
peaked.
Yeah.
He peaked. It's all downhill from here.
He peaked. From now on, all your other insect-related or pest-related activities will be much less successful, I'm sure.
Yeah, they'll just involve, like, the back of a shoe or something. Not a potato gun.
Much less exciting.